Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, February 17th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics by Lester Spence. He is a professor from Johns Hopkins University. This book is sort of a response to Cornel West's Race Matters and to David Harvey's A Brief History of Neoliberalism, and also, I think, to a certain extent, to Eddie Gloud's Democracy in Black, which is really fascinating to me, too, because in many ways, if you look from 50 feet away, Lester Spence and Eddie Gloud agree on a lot of things. But it is there is an academic term for this, but it's the primary assumptions. It's the field in which they're coming from when they look at that has trained them to look at something. You know, you could have a chemist and a biologist look at a human being, and they would come up with, they'd see the same human, but they would come up maybe with a different explanation as to what is the essence of that human being based upon the field in which they're trained. Does that make sense? And I don't know if this is accurate because I don't know enough about biology or chemistry, but you know, a chemist may say, well, I look at the human being and I say the essence of a human being is H2O, it's water. Whereas a biologist may say, no, the essence of a human being is a circulatory system or something. I don't know.
Why? It's like that parable of describing the elephant where a bunch of blind men describe an elephant. One has the tail, the other touches like his legs and stuff.
No, it is not like that. That is a great parable. But that says that both these blind men, they only see the part. Or, you know, I've also heard of like an ant describing an elephant. They only see the part that they're at. It's not that. It is basically like, it's if you and I are looking at an elephant and we have different colored glasses on. And that is the precursor to how we would describe it. Oh, this is a big, animal with a trunk and it's blue. And you say, no, this is a big animal and it's got a trunk and it's red. Basically, Lester Spence is saying that black intellectual analysis of the state of black America in some ways and our society is he's critiquing it because it's not being looked at as through the lens of political economy, as opposed to someone like Cornel West or Eddie Gloud, who look at it through the lens of different social sciences. I mean, they both come out of a religious tradition. And I would bet that he would also argue in terms of the same thing about Gary Dorian, who we had that though he's looking at black intellectual history. He's not a black intellectual himself. He's not black. But the idea that you cannot fully explain according to Lester Spence. I mean, he'll say more. But you cannot fully explain the experience of black people and or provide any type of solution to the situation if you do not look through it, look at black experience in America through this lens. And it really, I mean, I almost like it's, that was a spoiler alert because it took me almost the entire interview, I think, to fully grasp that concept. But how we get there, I think, will interest you. Tomorrow on the program, we'll snap back and get a little more practical. Members will hear on this program another famous Matt pick from the deep archives. Can't vouch for it, folks, but you trust Matt to pick good music. Why wouldn't you trust him to do this? Lastly, let me say this. I know that you all want to know what's going on in the world, but who has got the time? I mean, you listen to this program for politics, but what about just more a broader palette of news? TV news, too long, too boring, too much like a pep rally or a shouting match full of network bias. Well, some people have found a great way to ditch the talking heads and get only the news stories that you want in short bites and on your time. It's called Newsy. And it's changing the way we get our news. Newsy delivers the stories that you need to know without shouting, dragging on, or shoving an agenda down our throats. We're all busy, folks. God knows. I'm busy. But we need to stay in the know, and Newsy videos are less than 2 minutes. So you can get all the news you want in just 2 minutes each day. Check out Newsy today. I'm telling you, you'll be glad you did. Go to newsy.com/easy. That's newsy.com/easy. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Oh, and I should remind you that this program is completely funded by members. And when you join the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com, not only are you supporting the free show, but as a bonus, we give you usually an extra 50 minutes of us. This week, we're giving you a little bit of a smaller portion of archive of stuff, but we give you basically a second show. And the first show, the freebie show, commercial free. So that's an added bonus there. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Lester Spence. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program professor at Johns Hopkins University, Lester Spence. He is the author of Knocking the Hustle. Welcome to the program, professor.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you.
All right. Let's start with, I guess it's really the subtitle of your book, Dealing with Neoliberalism, Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Politics. We've talked a lot about neoliberalism on this program, but give us your definition of neoliberalism.
So I think about it in basically three ways. One is kind of a class project designed to distribute resources upwards to what we routinely now call the 1%. Second, as kind of a state transformation project whereby governments are transformed to promote a wide range of policies, privatizing a range of public services and reducing taxes. And then third is a project designed to get people in a range of institutions to kind of think of themselves as market actors, as entrepreneurs.
Let's start with that last element of it, because you reference, and this is going to be a little bit weird for our audience, I think, on some level. Well, not that weird, but you reference Jay-Z's line. I'm not a businessman. I'm a businessman. Now, I have to tell you that when I hear that now and when I read it, our contributor here, Michael, did a very mean Ben Carson impression and put out an album where put out a song where Ben Carson was singing that line. And so that's what I hear over and over again. But it is, I think it captures the idea that there is a certain commodification of, and I think this is happening across society, right? Of ourselves as brands, whether it's we're on Facebook or whether, you know, we're teaching our kids, you know, how many likes you get on Instagram is a value measure. How is this? Tell us why you brought that up. I mean, what that exposes for you.
My first book was a book of Staring in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, was actually a book that was about kind of showing how neoliberalism had kind of infected, in a way, black popular culture, using rap and hip-hop as the primary subject of analysis. So, and to a certain extent, I'm giving a shout-out to my own previous work by talking about Jay-Z, but more broadly, I'm using that to talk about how kind of this idea is now just become common sense, right? So we hear it in our music. Like you said, we see it in our, we kind of see it in our Facebook feeds. More important, we kind of embrace it ourselves. So people can talk routinely without even batting an eye about themselves as brands, about themselves as having to hustle. And then similarly, we routinely castigate and dismiss people who don't exhibit the capacity or even the desire to hustle or to think of themselves as businesses or to think of themselves in entrepreneurial fashion. And that's something, and I deal with it in the course of black politics, and more specifically, in part because I think that black populations tend to be, bear the brunt of the ill effects of neoliberalism, but also in part because I just don't see black scholars and those who take black life seriously really talking about the issue. So I want to kind of bring it to light.
Yeah, I mean, so let's talk about the idea of the hustle. What is the hustle and that you're knocking, I guess?
Yeah. So back in the day, so I'm 47. I was born in 69. When I was growing up, like the hustler was somebody who basically ran cons, right? That's what they did. They didn't really have a real job. They just basically were con artists. And when you talk about hustling, you know, somebody being hustled or somebody hustling, it was a pejorative. It was something you would use to describe somebody who was just trying to get over. But sometime in the 90s, that term kind of changes. And the hustler becomes somebody who's always working, right? And the hustle referred to that, just that process of consistently working either on yourself, you know, trying to get better, or working and grinding. And that becomes not just a descriptive of, you know, a certain type of labor activity. It also becomes a normative description. That is to say that the hustle becomes something that you're supposed to do. Like, good people hustle and bad people don't, right? So I'm knocking, that is, I'm criticizing that hustle, because I think it represents kind of the core of the neoliberal turn as it relates to just kind of people moving about their day. We're now routinely expected to hustle and to take on the primary responsibility for a wide range of concerns, largely because the state now has basically kind of removed itself from our lives in a progressive sense.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the evolution of that term. I mean, and I want to at one point, like, I mean, it's interesting because your book is also not necessarily a full on critique, but in some ways a slight corrective or a response to both Cornel West's Race Matters And David Harvey's brief history of neoliberalism, and I think we've had Harvey on the program to talk about that book in the past. And because we have, I mean, on one hand, we have this concept of neoliberalism, which is society wide, and it is, I think, I think clearly the case where because African Americans, I mean, there are other communities as well, but particularly African Americans, because of their history and the history of racism and white supremacy in this country, they're not so much the canaries in the coal mines, but they are the canaries in the coal mines. I mean, when we have these contractions, I mean, when, what is the saying? When white America catches a cold or sneezes,
black pneumonia.
Right, exactly. And
yeah.
This concept of hustle, because when I, and I'm more or less the same age as you, a little bit older, I remember, you know, the idea of Pete Rose, right? I remember both concurrently.
Oh, Charlie Hustle.
I guess they used to call him. And I also remember, you know, the idea of hustling. It's almost as if, because I still hear guys like Rush Limbaugh, right, talk about the race hustlers. Maybe he refers to Sharpton in this instance. And, putting aside for a moment a critique of Al Sharpton, it's interesting to see how those terms are used. And so I guess what I'm asking is where does it cross the racial divide, or how is it different the way that neoliberalism is impacting not just quantitatively, but qualitatively, black folk?
Oh, that's an excellent, excellent question. That's an excellent question. So quantitatively. So quantitatively, I think you're right. If you look at, if you look at unemployment over time, if you look at underemployment over time, you look at the spread of bad jobs that kind of attends neoliberalism, all those things are concentrated in non-white population, in black and Latino populations in general, and in black populations specifically. If you look at the growth of incarceration over time that attends neoliberalism, the growth in incarceration is concentrated among black men, and the fastest growing rate of incarcerated folk in general are black women. So that's the quantitative stuff, right? As far as the qualitative stuff, so you might want to, I would take a look at something like the spread of the prosperity gospel. Now, the prosperity gospel is prosperity gospel, which is kind of what the prosperity gospel basically does, for listeners who aren't aware, is it's a specific type of theology that renders religious texts, in this case the Bible, into basically entrepreneurial kind of neoliberal self-help guides. Now, we see the prosperity gospel in white communities, but in black communities, given the historical importance of the black church to black populations, it takes a very different role. And then if you look at cities with large black populations, now all cities, now if the neoliberal turn takes shape anywhere geographically, it really takes shape first in cities and then spreads out. There's a very different way that neoliberal turn looks in a city like Seattle, in a city like Portland, city with majority white populations, than it takes in a city like, say, Gary, Indiana, or most recently, a city like Flint in Michigan, or Detroit, or New Orleans.
Interesting. And so I want to circle back to that, because, you know, we spoke, I guess it was about a month ago, to Gary Dorian, who's been writing about the black social gospel. And in some ways, my sense is, and I'm not read up on this enough, but that prosperity gospel comes in, and there's two problems with it, it seems to me, in terms of what it does to the black community. It takes a pre-existing institution that was, in terms of, if you see the commodification of everything, and if you see markets becoming a solution for everything as problematic, it eliminated an institution that was a net positive in fighting against that type of thing and replaced it in some ways with an institution that is a net negative in terms of bringing that about.
That's exactly what it does. Yeah, that's exactly what it does. And it's funny, and it mobilizes, it still mobilizes populations, but it mobilizes populations kind of against themselves, right? Because what it basically says, not even implies, it says that if it connects material prosperity to spiritual prosperity, if you don't have material prosperity, then your spirit must not be prosperous, right? Then there must be something wrong with you, and you have to do the work on yourself. So you're, instead of being mobilized to pursue the public good and with other people, collective action, you're mobilized in order to kind of do the work on yourself in order to help yourself privately. And maybe that leads to, you know, to public action, but to the extent that leads to public action, that leads to charity. And we know that charity doesn't really do much to deal with inequality.
Right. And it's also an encouragement, I guess, to exploit other people. I mean, that's the whole concept of hustle, too, that you're saying, is that the hustle is when we have suppressed wages and higher productivity, that's what the hustle is, right? I mean, is that we're actually working more for as much, if not less. And in some ways, that's just simply a theft of our labor.
Yes, yes, yes. And then going back to the church example, right? So one of the ways you're kind of measured as far as how prosperous your spirit is how much you're tithing to your pastors, right? So prominent prosperity gospel pastors like Creflo Dollar, they make as much money as many CEOs, right? Creflo Dollar asked for and received from his congregation a $60 million jet. And they gave that, many of the people who gave that money are the same people who are struggling to pay their mortgages, are the same people who are underemployed, are the same people who are trying multi-marketing scheme after multi-marketing scheme to try to make ends meet.
So what is the black political system, what is the black intellectual life? I mean, what has been the ongoing conversation about this dynamic? About this growth?
So we've got increasing, so we've had, you know, black intellectuals have been kind of on the political spectrum, they've tended liberal to the left, you know, almost forever, right? Because of historical circumstances, right? But it's only now that we're actually starting to dig deep in political economy. And one reason why that's been the case is because our most prominent black intellectuals have come from the humanities rather than the social sciences, right? So Cornel West, for example, is a philosopher. Henry Louis Gates, who doesn't necessarily have left politics or even in some ways liberal politics, is a scholar of English. Michael Eric Dyson is a religious scholar. So what they're able to do is to talk really clearly about racism. They're able to talk really clearly about kind of how America's lost its moral compass. But what they haven't been able to talk about is political economy. And we're only now starting to get people to get purchase on the effect of, on the way the specific political economy affects black lives. And that's what my work represents, an attempt to kind of intervene. But you also have people like Kianga Yamada Taylor and a number of other folk who are starting to kind of drag black study, so to speak, back into the study of political economy. And it's really important because there's a sense in American communities in general that intellectual work isn't valuable, right? Unless we're talking about software. Right. But the reason why this scholarly work is important is because it's the scholarship that usually generates the intellectual ideas that people attempt to organize around, right? It's the scholarship that gives people a sense of what the problem is and what the solution is. I mean, we don't have the neoliberal turn itself without kind of a set of economic ideas about how the world works.
Right. I mean, and this is really fascinating to me because we, you know, you see what's happening with the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think, you know, someone like Michelle Alexander, I think, is a perfect example of someone who is putting out ideas that are, at the very least, either inspiring or are cited by members of that movement. I mean, putting aside the question of whether or not you see its efficacy, but give me your sense of, I mean, because it seems to me, I mean, just as someone who's, you know, basically just as an observer, that a combination of factors has led to as much activity as, and maybe I'm just paying more attention to these things, but there seems to me to be a growing activity within Black intellectual life and Black political life. And perhaps maybe it's because the sort of the shadow cast by civil rights leaders is, you know, is getting smaller as time goes on in some way, that there is a real, it's a very dynamic time for within Black intellectual life right now, and arguing, you know, what is the way forward. And also, you know, this is all happening in the backdrop of the first African-American president. I mean, so do you think that I don't know, I guess give me your critique of Cornel West and how this fits into this idea. I want you just to expand on sort of the perspective where Black intellectual life is coming from, as looking on sort of the Black experience in America.
So, you noted earlier correctly that one of the books I was kind of writing against was Cornel West's Race Matters, which was published in 1992, I think, like right after the Rodney King Rebellion. That book basically ended up causing a great deal of kind of ideational damage to kind of Black communities, in as much as it argued that the primary problem facing Black people was not the changing political economy. It wasn't even it was their own lack of self-worth and self-meaning. Right. So it was kind of it took a cultural turn away from political economy. And that cultural turn has been kind of the turn that to a certain extent I'm writing against. Right. When you take culture, the cultural terrain, as the primary site of politics and as the primary site of kind of conflict, then you remove the effect of politics totally. You remove the effect of economic structures, and you make it really, really difficult for us to kind of understand that shift that takes place when the bottom falls out of the economy and when political institutions are consistently transformed in order to meet the dictates of the market. You know, we could talk about racism pretty well, right? But you can't talk about that political economy stuff. And then what you also can't talk about is the role that class bifurcation plays within Black communities and within Black politics. So it kind of neuters our ability to exert kind of a critical lens, not just on our own society broadly, but on Black politics. But what's happened, you bring in Black Lives Matters, what's happened in large part through Black protests in places like St. Louis and here in Baltimore where I live, is that the fight against anti-Black police brutality has created a space by which we can now begin to think about institutions seriously. We can begin to think about how cities are governed seriously. And we still haven't kind of made the turn away from that cultural move exactly. You know, so we've got a lot of people writing about Beyonce's formation video as if that were the same thing as a political protest, and right, it's not. But we're moving far closer to a realm in which we can take politics and the economy seriously again.
Do you, I mean, has Cornel West, I mean, because it seems to me, you know, and I have to say that it's been many years since I've read Race Matters. But the critique that you're offering is one I think you could also make about something like President Obama's My Brother's Keeper program.
Oh, hell yes.
It's very much about, like, you know, the real issue here is that that, you know, we need to be more responsible. I mean, and
Black boys need to pull their pants up.
Right, exactly. And this is about individual behavior as opposed to something that is systemic. It seems to me that that West, and I don't want to make this about West per se. I just want to say if there's been some type of evolution, more broadly speaking, that West has now been critical of the president, at least presumably on some as a function of that tact, as opposed to dealing with the systemic problems that we've had, and sort of certainly the problems following 08, which hit Black communities the hardest.
Well, so, and thank you for bringing that up. That's excellent. So, it's for me, it's not just about critiquing the tendency West reflects, right? In the early 90s, he was one of the people arguing that kind of Black culture was partially the problem. But it's also the contemporary tendency West reflects, right? Where West has been really, really critical of Obama, but his criticism has no political economy in it, right? It's not precise enough in its understanding and his understanding of the effect of institutions, the role institutions play. His conception of politics is incredibly limited, and his conception of politics within Black communities is limited, right? So for him, the best reading would be to say that the reason Obama is functioning the way he is, the reason he's making the statements he's making, is because he's somehow a sellout, or because he doesn't love Black people, right? That's not really a sophisticated way of understanding the role class interests play. Right. It's very possible, moving from Obama to Michael Nutter, for example, who is a Philadelphia mayor, has made the same exact critiques against poor Black people. I would argue Michael Nutter really loves Black people. Right. But at the same time, I would argue that the way that love translates into policy and interest has been disastrous for poor Black populations. There's a significant difference in that type of take. That type of sophisticated take that comes from kind of a social science analysis that takes political economy seriously, and then this type of cultural take that says, okay, well, Obama must not love Black people, and that's why we're suffering.
Interesting. All right. So can you be more specific about what that proper critique would be? I mean, in other words, put some meat on that bone for us, if you could.
Yeah, thank you. So let's take Michael Nutter example, right? So Michael Nutter, there's a moment in time where Michael Nutter, where Philadelphia has a wave of murders, massive crime wave, and then a number of Black kids who were participating in smart mob events where they just gathering, beating folks down and fleeing. Then Michael Nutter goes to his own Black church, makes a speech basically condemning their behavior, saying that they're disregarding the race, that they're basically damning the race, and then enforces a curfew in neighborhoods with large black poor populations. Now, the simple critique is that he doesn't love Black people, that he's a sellout to his race. But the more sophisticated critique would say, okay, what Michael Nutter is doing there is he's making a set of political choices that don't take into account, for example, that Parks and Rec spending had not only been held constant, but they were like $15 million in the hole compared to what the city of Philadelphia should have given. The city of Philadelphia itself has been hamstrung in that they have an unelected body that basically determines how much they can spend on their budget. And the Philly budget actually has to go through that body before it's okayed, right? You can start to bring that into play. You talk about police spending. Police spending in Philadelphia and other major cities has increased significantly. Again, even as Parks and Rec's budget spending has remained constant. Those type of more, you know, putting meat on that bone, right, means actually going institution by institution and looking at the set of political choices that people like Michael Nutter are making and choosing between different segments of different segments of interest in cities. And then you can have like a laser-like type focus in the type of policy responses that we should make. Does that make sense?
Yes. So it's disaggregating sort of instead of focusing on the personality, it's disaggregating the sort of the smallest components. But ultimately, you got to go through that guy, right? I mean, So how does that? Go ahead.
And then the other thing, right, is that it then gives us. So adding flesh is not just about that critique, though, right? It's also about adding flesh to the response. So the response isn't simply speaking truth to power or large-scale direct action. The response should be kind of a grassroots political organizing institutional response. And that institutional response can then actually make policy interventions as opposed to kind of damning individuals as opposed to speaking truth to power.
And so that could take a form as just sort of an outside protest group or sort of an inside outside game. It could be electoral as well.
Yes, they could take a range of different. So in the city of Baltimore, for example, a group led by black youth were successfully able to halt a planned $104 million prison for quote unquote youth charged as adults, right? They did that employing direct action, but they also did that knowing public policy, right? Actually understanding really clearly where the public, what type of critiques to make against the public policy. They actually proposed alternative ways to use that money. And they deployed a wide range of tactics that really expressed that really showed a really sophisticated understanding of political economy and of politics.
So, in terms of the critique of race matters and what that represents, the idea is that you need to see the battlefield more clearly through this perspective to understand where you need to go next, and that is a question of I guess clarity in terms of understanding and having this political economy critique. So let's flip over to the other side where you critique Harvey's. Harvey's book on neoliberal policies. What is missing from that end of the spectrum, I guess?
So whereas Cornel West is dealing with black politics but ignores the role of class and political economy, David Harvey is, you know, taking class really seriously and political economy really seriously, but he's ignoring the role of race. I mean, you don't find, I mean, not like doing an index check actually is the best way to do this, but you just do a simple look at the back of the index and race doesn't appear at all, right? And for me, from the perspective of somebody who's kind of studied the history of this thing, it seems to me you cannot talk about the neoliberal turn itself without talking about racial politics in America. It's not something race and class work together. It's not that class conditions create racism. It's that they historically work together. So when you've got that ideational gap in the 70s, right, where economic theorists, you know, because the economy crashes in ways that economic theorists wouldn't have predicted, you know, everybody's like, oh my God, what do? We have no idea what we do, because the thing we would usually use, you know, economic theory, is broken. So in that gap, you know, comes in folks who are promoting neoliberal policies. But the thing is those policies are so disastrous for people. In an American context, we still have to explain why they accept the policies, because all these policies are hurtful for them. What is it that causes these people to support these massive tax cuts? What is it that causes people to gut the welfare state? What is it that causes people to accept a punitive term, right? That's where racial politics comes in. And Harvey doesn't talk about that stuff in any of his work. Even the stuff about Baltimore only deals with racial politics a little bit. And that's the thing that just doesn't make sense empirically. And then because he's not talking about how it works in racial politics, he can't really talk about how it works in black communities. So that's where the work comes into play. It's like, okay, well, I can use, you know, I kind of use the first chapter to talk about how race plays a role in the turn, and then you then use the rest of the book to talk about how it affects black communities.
And I mean, in your sense, is it your sense that that race, at least in the context of this country, that race is a predicate for neoliberal policies, or is it sort of used as a tactic in the sort of, I guess, more efficient execution of neoliberal policies?
Oh, that's a great question. I would suggest that everywhere you've got racialized populations, that racialized population ends up becoming the key to which the neoliberal turn occurs. There's significant evidence that suggests that this occurred in Great Britain, for example, in the 70s, and then there's evidence it's occurred similarly in other countries, and I think it definitely takes a role. I think it definitely works that way here.
So in other words, the first place these policies are tried out are within the context of, I'm just thinking in terms of like, I mean, Clinton's welfare reform, right, is a sort of is a prime example of. We're going to start with people who are on welfare, and nobody cares about them because they're on welfare. And so we're going to introduce this market reform where, you know, you'll get welfare, but you got to get a job, and that you got to get a job even if there are no jobs. I mean, this is why we had such a huge crisis of food stamps in 2008 is because of this welfare reform. I mean, is that basically the argument that this is where it starts, and then the currency of this dynamic grows so that then it becomes? I mean, I guess this is where we're seeing it with school privatization, right? With charter schools, right? It starts first window that's pried open is we need to help poor communities, or we need to help African American urban communities that don't have access, and the best way to do it is a market solution.
Yep. So both nationally and internationally, when you have democracy is kind of required for the turn to take place, that's when you see racial populations used, right? That's when you see kind of racism used. And there are a number of places, like Chile is actually the first example that the policy's rolled out, but that policy, you know, the policy's rolled out there through force, basically. But anywhere you've got democracy, you need some kind of racialized other. And you've been talking about, we talk about welfare reform in the 90s, but we can also talk about kind of the move to kind of the tax revolt, right? The first major tax revolt we've got in the United States in the modern era is, I think, Prop 13 in California.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it takes California from having basically the best educational system and one of the most affordable educational systems in the country to one of the worst. Researchers at UCLA, David Sears, and I forget the other brother, they found pretty persuasive evidence that the reason that proposition, which basically capped property taxes and made it incredibly, incredibly difficult for for California municipalities to increase taxes, that the best predictor of support for that tax cut was racial resentment, not party ID. You know, not whether you're a Republican or Democrat, not even ideology, whether you're a liberal or conservative, the best predictor was racial resentment. And again, what you've got is large white populations who believe that the tax money is being spent inappropriately on populations of color, and they all of a sudden want to peel that back. Just like with the, so, you know, moving back to the welfare example, the idea was that you had all these black women who were basically stealing money, having all these kids, so we needed to actually make them work. That's how it works.
It's fascinating stuff. The book is Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics by Lester Spence. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. You can buy it at punctumbooks.com, either as an ebook or as a printed book. Lester Spence, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man.